Hi there, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Ian Cook, and today we're talking about Entangled Urbanism, Slum, Gated Community, and Shopping Mall in Delhi and Gurgaon by Sanjay Srivastava. The book is published by Oxford University Press, and Sanjay is a professor and head of sociology at the Institute of Economic Growth in Delhi. This book is a wonderfully readable piece of urban anthropology. It explores the ways in which spaces and processes are interconnected in the city, and we move from temples that resemble shopping malls through the gates of luxury apartments and into the electricity supply networks of slums. And in doing so, the book pulls together all the different threads that entangle city dwellers with one another. Really is my new favourite piece of urban anthropology. I'm absolutely obsessed with this book, and I hope you enjoy listening to me speaking with Sanjay. Okay, so it gives me great pleasure to welcome Sanjay to the show. Thanks a lot for your wonderful book, and thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for the opportunity.
Wonderful. Okay, so before we talk about your book itself, could you please briefly tell us a little bit about your past academic interests and how it fed into this project?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm an anthropologist, and my first book, which was called Constructing Postcolonial India, National Character and the Dune School, was about a school, a boarding school. It's about three different boarding schools where I was, you know, interested in, well, not so much in classroom schooling and pedagogy as such, but the broader context within which certain kind of nationalist education developed. So the the key focus of my study was a school called the Dune School, which is a very famous boarding school for boys. She produced lots of well-known men, novelists and politicians, et cetera, et cetera. And I was particularly interested in that study on the links between education, nationalism, middle-class modernity, and science, and also on issues of space and time, and how might one think about specific spaces of schooling that produce certain ideas around nationalism. And when I was writing, doing that particular project, the city began to kind of figure quite significantly in the project in terms of thinking about histories of Indian nationalist imagination, because historically it's been about the village and the village as the essential India. But here, you know, you came across lots of images and symbols of the city, the manner in which a school was organized as kind of an urban space, as a contractual space rather than a village space. So the city was seen as a space, as the urban was seen as a space where India was going to move to, so the school was a space where no one was supposed to know each other's caste in a similar way that the city is supposed to be contractual rather than personalized spaces. So in a sense, the city has been very significantly a part of the Indian nationalist imagination. So that first work interested me much more significantly in the ideas of the city. And of course, I've always been interested in spaces, the spaces both in the material and symbolic aspects. So that was my first work. And, you know, the Dune School, for example, when it was established on the premises of what was earlier a laboratory or a botanical garden, which was like a garden of science. So there were very deliberate symbolic efforts to locate a nationalist school, which was established in 1935, around ideas of urban modernity and science. So that was my first work, which interested me in about how to think about urban spaces as part of larger processes of modernity and science and nationalism in the non-Western world. My second monograph, which was called Passionate Modernity, Sexuality, Class, and Consumption in India, was actually much more explicitly about the city, but the sexual cultures of the city, intimacy, ideas of pornography, and how they circulate within the city, and how they are built around ideas of the urban. So I carried out fieldwork at what in India, I'm sure some of your listeners and you might know, are called sex clinics, where men go to, working class men, for so-called sex problems, but also how to have a male child. So I was interested here in this particular context, and again, about the various processes of the city, lives of poor migrant men in the city, transit points such as bus stations and train stations, where knowledges about cities circulate, consumer cultures in the urban environment, the sexual geography of the city. And since then, I've also kind of written various journal articles and book chapters about different aspects of the urban. And I've also made a documentary film about an urban village in Delhi. Urban villages are these kind of, you know, Delhi, of course, as you might know, was built over a number of villages. And some of these villages remained even after New Delhi was built. And they got surrounded by the city that is currently Delhi. So I have also made a film on urban villages. So I've had a long-standing interest in urban issues, and some of my past work kind of feeds into the current project, this book, Entangled Urbanism, that we're talking about.
Wonderful, wonderful. Okay, that brings us nicely to talk about entangled urbanism. And as the subtitle of your book suggests, it's about slums or settlements, about gated communities, and also about shopping malls, both in Delhi and Gurgaon. And we're going to talk about each of these three spaces in our conversation. But I thought before we do turn to speak about these spaces, could you please tell us a little bit about a couple of the guiding ideas that you bring up in this introduction? So of the books, firstly, you have this wonderful idea in the beginning when you say the city is like an argument, and also the title of the book itself, Entangled Urbanism. So could you unpack those two concepts for us a little?
Well, I'm interested in spaces, of course, and I'm influenced a great deal by urban geographers who, you know, much more specifically address the issue of space as social, as both object and also a process. But I'm also interested in biographies and as a method within social anthropology and sociology and social science, in the sense of what do people's lives tell us about the structures within which we all live, structures of power, about structures of emotions, about the ways in which we deal with the world. One of the ideas why I began with an epigraph about the cities like an argument is, of course, all cities are contested spaces of different kinds. So here the contest in Delhi and other such cities around the world would be between different kinds of people, the so-called well-off, the not so well-off. So people live in slums, and people live in gated communities, and different processes that this leads rise to. The other, at least for me, a significant idea behind the book is not to think of a city as having an essence. You know, so we have like tourist brochures where Paris is about love, for example, and other cities have their own kind of promotional spiels about what they're about. They're developed historically in certain ways. And I reading the work of, you know, anthropologists and human geographers, you always have a sense about the fact that the city is a far more complex place than simply about that something that can be captured through one particular descriptor. So Entangled Urbanism, the book, is about the ways in which cities should be seen as produced through a series of relationships between different kinds of populations. And certain non-Western cities have extraordinarily varied populations. Rather than being seen as autonomous realms, rather than being seen as consisting of autonomous realms, you know, the gated community and a shopping mall and a slum and a better-off locality, that have nothing to do with each other. So I wanted to look at cities as a series of interlocking processes, because my familiarity with the stuff that I've learned from others who've written about it is to cities as so being about elite localities or about slums. But I was interested in looking at having read in a wide range of stuff, which is about specific spaces of the cities. I was really interested in looking how these spaces are interlinked. What is it to think about how middle-class activism to remove certain so-called dirty spaces in a place like Delhi, what does it mean in terms of how it impacts upon other people's lives? So that is the kind of entanglement that I was interested in. So in a sense that, of course, one is, of course, you know, like, most anthropologists and stuff, while we study poor people and rich people, there's very little, whilst we may have certain political positions, you also feel kind of helpless about the state of the world. So one aspect of trying to think about the city as a series of entangled spaces is also to see this project as a kind of a political and ethical project about saying, well, how does one kind of activity affect someone else's life? So whilst on the one hand, I see it as a kind of a intervention, which is also political in the way we think about the social and how the social is organized, about how, you know, how if one kind of action in one part of the city affects another, someone else's life. It is that, but it's also an intellectual and methodological experiment about thinking about, rather than thinking of the city as a series of splintered spaces, which is, of course, another paradigm. I'm trying to think about the city, certainly the non-Western city, as a series of entanglements, which then allows me to say that I, as a resident of a specific kind of city, the kinds of actions that I take as a relatively privileged person, obviously has effect upon someone else's life. So it's both an ethical project, but also, I think, an intellectual and methodological experiment. So, you know, as you know, the city is about malls and highways and theme parks and slums and bureaucracies. And so I'm really interested in seeing how one imagines the city as a series of effects upon that one particular kind of action has upon another space. That's what I meant by entangled urbanism. I guess I could have just done a book just on gated communities, but then the manner in which a gated community comes about, the manner in which clean spaces, so-called clean spaces in a city like Delhi are created, the manner in which a global city is sought to be created, means also the removal of other kinds of spaces and other kinds of people from those spaces. So that's what I meant by entangled urbanism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it comes through really well as you read a book, and this is one of the joys, I guess, of reading a book length piece of work, is that this entanglement really is there as you move through the spaces, but exactly guided by yourself as the anthropologist, and really you keep getting reminded of the previous people that we met earlier on in the book. So this really works really well, and it was a really enjoyable read. But now let's talk about the first section, which is called Spaces of the Periphery, Subjects of the Center. And this is I suppose a really rich and at times actually also terribly sad account of an informal settlement in Delhi, which is called Nangla. And there's three chapters in this section. And I think one of the common themes that kept coming up for me when I was reading it, and it, I think at the end of the second chapter here, it really explicitly comes out, is that there's a search for permanence amongst many of these residents. So I was wondering, could you tell us why you think that permanence was so important for these residents, and what the role the state played in bringing about or stopping this permanence?
Well, I think, you know, like, you know, most cities like Delhi around the world, whether in Africa and stuff, are, and most countries around the world, you know, in the Northwestern context, one of the most significant of the social life of such societies is mobility. You have large numbers of people who are moving from village to a larger village, to a smallish town, to a larger town, and eventually, hopefully, to a metropolitan town. So intra-country diaspora is massive, right? People move in search of jobs. People move because they get displaced, because dams get built or whatever. But I think primarily also, you know, people move in search of jobs. Now, despite the fact that all these societies are marked by such extraordinary mobility, the most significant way in which you can access your rights actually built around providing a proof of permanence, right? You need, if you want in India, for example, a government ID cards that allow you to access cheap food, the so-called ration card. And now they're called below poverty line cards, for example. Right? You need proof of residence, which for large numbers of people are really difficult to provide, because they've spent half their life moving from one place to another to earn a livelihood. And that's certainly the kinds of people that I was working with in this part of the book. And so the desire for the proof of residence is a desire which allows you to which is built, which is because of the fact that it allows you access to different kinds of subsidized food or hospital or schooling facilities, etc. So this is the kind of, so the search for permanence, a permanent address in a context we are constantly having to move on, is really a search for a livelihood and access to resources. And that's why permanence is so significant. The search for permanence is such a significant aspect for people's life. It's not only to have a foothold, a place where you live, but it's also an access to goods for survival, right? And it's a search of permanence in a society and societies where there's such huge, large-scale mobility. So how do you get permanence? So you try getting proof of permanence through, you know, maybe ID cards, and you can't get a genuine ID card because you can't provide a proof of permanence. So you get people to get you a fake ID card, and in the hope that that fake ID card at some point in time will get you a genuine ID card. So the relationship between fakeness, genuineness is a very complex one. And that's what I was interested in terms of exploring the city as a site for poor people to search for this permanence. And the state is, of course, an overwhelming factor in people's lives, although we now have theories of neoliberalism which suggests that increasingly people are moving into sort of private worlds and entrepreneurship in countries like India and in many other countries like in other parts of the non-Western world. The state continues to be the most significant actor in the lives of poor people. And in fact, you know, if you speak to poor people in India, certainly a relatively poor people, it is not that what they most desire is private sector jobs. In fact, what they most desire is actually government jobs. So in this part of the book, I was interested in both ethnographies of the state. How do people on an everyday basis deal with the state? And how does the state deal with them? What is the state? So, you know, people trust the state, but the trust is not reciprocated because the state itself is not any kind of neutral thing, as we know from the studies of various recent studies. It's made up of the different kinds of people who make up the state. I mean, so there's that other theory of the state which always saw the Weberian theory of the state, which saw the state as this fixed thing, neutral, above society. Whereas in everyday life, of course, it is fickle. It has peculiar relations with poor people, and poor people have peculiar relations with the state. So the state is that everyday thing with whom people really desire, but that love is not reciprocated. And that's why that part of the book is really about kind of the everyday state and how people deal with it, and people and different kind of strategies that people have to deal with the state. Because the state that they see, in fact, in the Nangla, the slum that was demolished that I talked about, the state was a kind of a drunk official who would come every second day to do a survey or the other. He became a part of the locality, that slum called Nangla. So that there were always blurred boundaries between the people in the state, which makes for very difficult dealings with the state. Because because although we imagine the state to be this formal mechanism where you know where you stand, it has rules and regulations, in its everyday incarnations, it's a very fickle thing. And it's that fickleness that I was interested in exploring, and what are the strategies that people have in order to deal with the fickleness. If the state is fickle, well, I think one of the things that people did at Nangla is to employ just as kind of fickle strategies to deal with it. The kind of magical strategies that, for example, others have described, people like Michael Taussig have talked about. And I think that city is that part of the book is really kind of ethnographies of the state through looking at everyday interactions that people have with the state. And rather than have a moral position on faking, getting fake documents, that part of the book is really about what happens in a city, so that people try and gain the maximum they can out of a state in a deeply asymmetrical society, in a very deeply divided city. And that's what really that section is about.
It's a wonderful idea. I think it's in the third chapter when you say the state has a certain mood, and how people have to read the mood of the state as if the state was a person in good mood or in a bad mood and so on. But let's move on to the second section, which is quite a different space. But as you mentioned earlier, it's a space that's also entangled with the slum, and that's the gated community. And you have a discussion about various middle-class residents' lives, and you suggest that their practices can in some way be framed as something which is post-national. So I was wondering, could you explain what you mean by this and how it plays out in the city?
I'll just begin by saying what I don't mean by post-national, because it is a term that's been used in other contexts as well. Mm-hmm. So I don't mean by post-national that the nation state is insignificant, because that was something that was in the mid-90s, there was this argument around that there are these post-national social formations, such as NGOs, and that the nation state is now insignificant. I'm increasingly that position has now been kind of revised to say that the nation state is not insignificant. It revises that the state certainly appears in different incarnations, even with the rise of globalization. So that's not what I mean by post-national. I also don't mean by post-national a kind of a critique of the nation state. And that's the other thing, that we should be post-national in order to suspend the idea of the nation state and think of this is not a theoretical political horizon that we are. I'm not using post-national as a theoretical political horizon to think beyond the nation state. I'm deploying post-nationalism here in a very almost like a descriptive term. Hopefully it's not empiricist, but what I mean by it is how contemporary nationalist ideas and emotions are entangled with the new practices of consumerism and the associated cultures of privatization and individuation. So how does the national emotion continue to be a significant aspect of everyday life and practice, but is expressed through the newer entanglements with cultures of consumerism, which are also about cultures of privatization and individuation. So ideas of the new individual. So specifically, for example, how do ideas of public-private partnership play out, both in terms of commercial activity, but also newer notions of the nation state and how the new nation state ought to be organized, what ought to be its relationship with the private sector and citizenship. How, for example, India, there's been rise of activity by what in India are referred to as resident welfare associations, which are akin to like neighborhood associations in the US, I guess. So RWAs, resident welfare associations in India, are primarily middle class associations. There's been a rise of middle class activism through RWA politics, which I think is part of a post-national environment, whereby at an earlier point in Indian history, the nationalism was, of course, a middle-class activity, but it was by middle-class people, but on behalf of the poor. I think the post-national moment is that moment where a great deal of middle-class activism is increasingly conducted on behalf of what are seen as middle-class interests, and also the rise of the citizen consumer. So what I mean by post-nationalism is a reconfiguration of the relationship between, say, the state and middle-class people, and a redefinition of the relationship and reconfiguration relationship also between the state and the corporate sector, which is actually a massive move, because historically the Indian state was seen as a developmentalist state, right? A state that was primarily acting on behalf of the poor. Increasingly, the state is seen as a state that is a friend of the middle classes. So in Indian popular culture, for example, now the hero of Bollywood cinema is not the person who saves on behalf of the nation state. Right? In the 50s and 60s, it was the dam builder, the scientist, the doctor, the person who was not a conspicuous consumer who was the national hero. From the 1990s onwards, Indian popular culture, the national hero is the consumer, right? The man who is global, the man who is who is transnational, who is a consumer, because it's consumption that links the nation state to the world. I think that's the big shift. That's what I'm thinking of when I use the term the post-national period. So the nationalism continues to be significant, but it is increasingly entangled with global cultures, consumerism, and in different kind of realms, whether it's public private partnerships and road building, or electricity distribution, privatization, of infrastructure, that in different realms you will have a very different idea of the nation state, a different idea of individuation. So that's what I meant by the post-national, because I am also, you know, also I'm deeply interested in how consumer cultures reorganize our lives beyond just buying goods. What do they actually mean to us as different kinds of people? And that's where my interest is located in terms of thinking about the city, thinking about cultural and social change that's happening.
Thank you. If I may, I just ask one more question on this section, more of a methodological question, because I think one of the reasons why, at least in urban studies or in South Asia, we know very little about the super rich, because they're behind gates, they're hard to reach. I was wondering, how did you go about finding these people? I mean, how did you go about as an anthropologist doing the research?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question? It's echoing
sure.
a bit.
Okay, I'm just saying, like, methodologically, how did you get to meet the rich in the gated communities? How did you go about?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and it's a question that anthropologists don't often ask each other.
Yes.
because, I mean, we assume that, you know, you just go into the field and start doing your stuff. Well, you know, like, it's an interesting question in this particular context, because clearly you have to have access to people who otherwise would not give. It's not like working in a village, right? You go to a village and you set up shop, and in a sense, the anthropologist who goes to a village is in a sort of a relatively powerful position, and you can ask questions and you can ask people to come and visit you, and people will. But this is the gated community kind of work is with people who really have, to whom you are the supplicant. I mean, they don't really have any, they have nothing to gain from you, and don't particularly, and they are usually much more powerful and richer than you are. So it has to be through a series of contacts. I mean, it's classic middle class fieldwork. I mean, I think that this kind of fieldwork, this particular kind of fieldwork, and it's a really good question because it's a very difficult question. It's a fraught question to answer. It is a question. It is the kind of fieldwork that you do if you have access to a certain kind of people, because you may have, because they think that you're like them. You get access to certain kinds of people. You may have access to certain kinds of people because you may have been to similar schools or colleges or universities, and have or a meet at other kinds of forums. So you get access to that world because you go along with the idea that they think that, after all, you are one of them. Mm-hmm. That's just. But I think it's something that anthropologists don't discuss often enough. Increasingly, it is something that we should be talking about, because anthropological fieldwork is now of a different kind. People don't only work in villages. So the question of how you get access to this other kind of world of power and the well-off and the elite is an important question. It's a question of method. It's a question of how certain kinds of anthropology is also an anthropology is done under a series of through pretense and through not disclosing certain kinds of things, which has always been a way that we produce knowledge in any case. But I think it's become much more a question that we need to address much more significantly, because the manner in which we produce knowledge stands in a sense exposed, because we don't, all of us no longer work in villages, you know. And so the simplest answer would be to your question is that you dissimulate in some ways. You go through people that you know. You let people assume that there is a shared world between the anthropologist and the people that he or she is talking to. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, I mean, this kind of work, you know, anthropology that works with the rich and the powerful is a much more difficult thing to do, because there's no particular reason why that group of people would give you access to their world. I mean, you're the supplicant, and you just have to, unlike the other kind of anthropology, where you're not the supplicant, you're very much in a powerful position. So these different kinds of strategies become important when you do field work. That what's the term? The field work that you looking up kind of field work rather than looking down kind of field work.
Yes. As opposed to in the first part of the book where you were considered sometimes to be a government agent or someone like this when you're when you were around the slum. Okay, let's talk about now about the final section of the book. And this again is centered on consumption, or maybe more directly centered on consumption in this section. But not just amongst the rich of the city, but also in the final chapter, you talk about in villages at the periphery and also about temple goers as well, who are this sort of in between middle class category that you discussed. So I was wondering, could you please tell us how and why consumption plays such an important role in building the contemporary urban imagination?
The final bit it's about one chapter is about a religious theme park. Another one is a shopping mall. And another one is about this pyramid selling scheme, which has great deal of patronage from the poor. The reason why that bit interests me is to look at again the relationship. I think consumerism is a very significant theme in the book. The chapter on the religious theme park is a chapter that I was particularly interested in how long-standing belief systems are being reformulated within the urban context. What happens to religion when it comes to the city? What happens to how do people in an urban environment, which is meant to be largely not irreligious, but certainly secular in that sense of having a distance from religion. What is urban religiosity about? How does it express itself? How is it connected, as also much more significantly, to the non-religious realm, which is the state? So I explored in that particular chapter, which is on this very famous, now very famous theme park in Delhi, which is the Akshardham Temple, which is on the banks of the Yamuna. Yamuna River, how that space was constructed through a relationship that the sect, Hindu sect that constructed that huge temple complex, through the relationship they had with the state. So it's not that the state is distant from religion. The land was got very cheaply because the government of the day was inclined to give the land to the particular religious sect at a throwaway price. It ensured that the temple got built. The temple itself is built along the themes of after the people who run this particular sect, some of their members visited Disneyland, they visited Universal Studios, and they built a temple along the lines of Disneyland, Universal Studios. And part of the idea behind the temple is to reinterpret Indian nation along very specific lines of Hindu nation, a certain kind of right-wing Hinduism. So I was interested really in exploring the city here not as a universal, so unilineal space where you move from being less religious to more religious to less religious, but the manner in which again there's an entanglement between the past and the present. And the past is very much a part of the contemporary city, certainly in a city like Delhi, where the past in terms of religion here is collapses into a futuristic vision of religiosity, which is built around an IMAX theater, a kind of a boat ride through 10,000 years of Indian history. So I was really interested in how time and space are entangled in ways which are not unilinear, but are kind of collapsed in one particular space. So the ancient past can be so easily represented through technologies of the future. And that is also the way in which cities like Delhi are increasingly being reimagined, and people are not. So that urban space is not simply space that is very distant from the past. Right? It's not a unilineal development of space. So I'm really interested in that particular chapter in looking at the relationship between the past and the present as they are spatialized in the city through this particular religious theme park. And then the next chapter, which is about shopping malls, you know, it kind of flows on from that way of that Disney temple, if I could put it that way, chapter, in as much as you have now different kinds of spaces which are linked to each other. So the shopping mall chapter is really a space that is linked to the earlier temple space, because I think increasingly we do have the production of religious spaces which are not very different from shopping mall spaces. And in fact, many, and I remember talking to a group of women who, when I asked them, they'd visited a shopping mall, one of them said, oh, I've been to Akshardham Temple. And because for a minute, she actually did think that that was like a shopping mall. So, and that final chapter, which is about consumerism, the urban poor, which is urban poor, which is about the pyramid selling scheme, again tries to think about the manner in which consumer cultures define, influence the life not only of the well off, but of the poor, and the kinds of hopes and aspirations that people build into consumer culture as something that offers them a different kind of future, but doesn't always deliver. But that is the point behind consumer culture. It offers you a certain hopes about future, but doesn't often deliver. But it keeps offering you that hope. So both the rich and the poor in a city like Delhi are deeply entangled in processes of consumerism. And in fact, that company that I looked at is the final chapter, which is the pyramid selling scheme, where lots of poor people in Nangla, the slum that I explore early on in the book I'm involved in, is the company is called Revolution Forever, right? So it puts forward the idea that consumerism can bring about a revolution in your life, and people go about buying these kind of goods from that company, enrolling more and more people down the line in order to generate more and more income. It's a pyramid selling scheme. But of course, the problem with all pyramid selling schemes is that you have endless hopes, which are almost never fulfilled. So for me, that particular section is something that that is important because it links both the rich and the poor. It links the state and those realms which we think of as non-state, such as religion. It allows me to explore the city as those series of entanglements that I've been sort of talking about throughout the book.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the book. So thanks a lot for conversation about it. And so I was wondering, now that this book is out, what are your current and future projects?
Well, I continue to work on another project in urbanism. I'm looking at, gone back to Gurgaon, looking at how specific spaces that are being created through a series of collaborations between middle-class citizens, bureaucracies. For example, one particular project that I'm looking at is there is every Sunday in Gurgaon, this new city that I talk about in this particular book on the borders of Delhi. Every Sunday, they have something called a rahagiri, which means streetness or taking over the street, which is comes from an idea which I think begins in Colombia. There's something called cyclovia, where people, every one day of the week, the streets are shut off and you have no cars, only sort of cycles and people on bicycles. And this is also something that's been started in Gurgaon some years ago, where on Sunday morning, 4 or 5 hours, so-called citizens take over the street. There's no traffic, and people walk around, and you can get free bicycles, and you know, you kind of you bicycle around. So it's the idea of people taking over the streets. But I'm really interested. I've been looking at it ethnographically about how this notion of the street and public spaces has been something that's been produced through a collaboration between middle-class citizens, the real estate developers who are interested in producing the notion of a community so that they can further market the other localities that they are producing in Gurgaon, and the media, for example. So the media also sponsors this particular Rahagiri movement because there are, Gurgaon is a growing area. There are newspapers, there are television channels that also are, it's a very important marketing area. So that's another thing, that project that I'm working on, looking at creation of spaces through these kind of collaborations that are happening. And I'm also working on a project on new labor, which is the government of India has this huge skills development program. So I've been doing some field work in a so-called Maoist affected areas. The government of India wants to train people in these so-called Maoist affected areas to become, I guess, in effect, like mall workers. So I'm interested in new ideas of work. And what does, how do you convert, what is the idea of work in a context in, I'm working in the state of Jharkhand, which has, you know, very strong Maoist movements. So how does one imagine work in a context where the most significant experience for young people has been Maoist activity, left-wing, extreme left-wing activity. So this project is really about kind of the whole notion of turning potential Maoists into mall workers. What does skill mean in the context of consumer culture as a global economy? Because the government of India is putting in vast amounts of money, hundreds of millions of dollars, certainly. So I'm interested in the social and cultural dimensions of work, the meaning of work. This kind of work, of course, has been done for the, I don't know, you might remember in the U.S., there was a project that was done with Delta Airlines. It was a book called The Managed Heart, which looks at emotional labor. So in this particular context, I'm really interested in new labor, also notions of emotional labor, but in a very different context than the U.S. And also trying to think about what neoliberalism actually means. What is it? That how does it actually come to localize itself in very, very poor contexts? What is the social meaning and cultural meaning of social exclusion? Poor people from really poor backgrounds, how do they reimagine themselves, try and reinvent themselves if they have to go and work in a shopping mall? And part of that work has also been done at an air hostess training academy, where you get lots of kids from small towns and villages who want to be cabin crew. And what are the skills they have to learn? What does it mean to try and reinvent yourself in a 12-month period when you have, say, 18 years of your life spent in a very different social and cultural environment? So these are some of the things that I've been working on.
Wow, wonderful. They both sound like, they all sound like really wonderful projects. So we look forward to reading about those in the future. Okay, there's not much more for me to do apart from to thank you again for your wonderful book, and thanks a lot for coming on New Books in South Asian Studies.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about these projects and the book. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for downloading the New Books in South Asian Studies podcast. I've been your host, Ian Cook, and today we've been talking about Entangled Urbanism by Sanjay Srivastava. I really hope you've enjoyed listening to our conversation as much as I enjoyed reading the book and speaking with Sanjay, and I hope you download again next time. Ta-da.